Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good afternoon. My name is Ellen Gobler. I manage the Graduate Council Lectures, and we're pleased to have all of you here today. Thank you so much for joining us. It's my pleasure to introduce Andrew Zeri.
Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Zeri. I'm Dean of the Graduate Division, and we're pleased, along with Graduate Council, to welcome you to the Charles and Martha Hitchcock Lecture Series. Our speaker today is Neil Shubin. The story of how the endowment came to Berkeley is a nice example of the ways in which this campus is linked to the history of California and of the Bay Area. Dr. Charles Hitchcock was a physician for the Army and came to San Francisco during the Gold Rush, where he opened a thriving private practice. In 1885, Charles established a professorship here at Berkeley as an expression of his long-held interest in education. His daughter, Lily Hitchcock Coit, still treasured in San Francisco for her personality as well as her generosity with respect to towers, greatly expanded her father's original gift to establish a professorship at Berkeley, making it possible for us to present a series of lectures. The Hitchcock Fund has become one of the most cherished endowments of the University of California, recognizing the highest distinction of scholarly thought and achievement. Now I would like to invite William Lester, Professor of Chemistry and Chair of the Hitchcock Professorship Committee, to say a few words about our speaker, Professor Neil Shubin. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dean Zeri. Good afternoon. Although you've heard it before, I'm William Lester, Professor of Chemistry and Chair of the Hitchcock Professorship Committee. On behalf of the Hitchcock Committee, I'm pleased to welcome Neil Shubin as this year's speaker in the Charles M. and Martha Hitchcock Lecture Series. Neil Shubin is a distinguished paleontologist whose research seeks to understand the mechanics behind the evolutionary origin of anatomical features of animals. His work focuses mainly on the Devonian and Triassic periods to understand the pivotal ecological and evolutionary shifts that occurred during that time. In 2004, after scouring the Canadian Arctic for 6 years, Shubin and his team unearthed Tiktaalik rosacrae, a fossil fishapod which, despite its fish-like features, had a neck, skull, ribs, and parts of limbs similar to land animals. This discovery represents the transition between fish and four-legged mammals that occurred over 350 million years ago. His announcement about the discovery of this phenomenon on April 6, 2006, in the journal Nature made front-page news in newspapers worldwide. Finding the 375 million-year-old fossil also spurred Shubin to write the recent book, Your Inner Fish, a journey into the 3.5 billion year history of the human body, arguing that fish provide an important evolutionary step in human history. Shubin received his BA from Columbia University in 1982. He earned his PhD from Harvard University in organismic and evolutionary biology in 1987. And in 1996, he was awarded an honorary MA from the University of Pennsylvania. He was a Miller Postdoctoral Fellow at UC Berkeley from 1987 to 1989 and held positions as an assistant, associate, and full professor of biology at the University of Pennsylvania before joining the faculty of the University of Chicago in 2000. Shubin is currently the Robert R. Bensley Professor of Organismal Biology and Anatomy. He serves as the Associate Dean of the Biological Sciences Division and is a member of the Committee on Evolutionary Biology. Shubin has been honored with a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Marcus Singer Award, and was named Person of the Week by ABC News for the week of April 7th, 2006. In addition, he has appeared on the Colbert Report and Public Radio International. Please join me in welcoming Professor Neil Shubin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Zeri, Professor Lester, members of the Hitchcock Committee, my hosts in the Department of Integrative Biology here at Berkeley. Thank you for the honor of being a Hitchcock professor, and thanks also for giving me the opportunity to return to Berkeley, which is the place of my intellectual roots. Much of what I do is really sort of flowed from the concepts, ideas, and approaches that I learned during my time here at Berkeley. So today we're going to talk about the Great Transformations. And if you take the 4.5 billion year history of our planet, you can begin to visualize it in a number of different ways. And one of the most common ways to visualize the history of our planet is as some sort of linear series of events. And so this is one taken from a textbook. It's from Presson Siever, a very prominent geology textbook. And what you see is, you know, this linear series is depicted as sort of a corkscrew, so they can, you know, fit it on the page. And you know, you see the various events and the trajectory in the history of our planet and the history of life on our planet. You know, from the presence of the first rocks, the earliest visible life in the fossil record, the origin of bodies and plants and animals, and then you see sort of the major events in the history of vertebrate life, creatures with bones, the shift from water to land, the shift to the origin of dinosaurs, and so forth. When you look at the world this way, in this sort of linear way, from beginning to present, what you sort of see is there are times that kind of look revolutionary, where there's sort of revolution in the air, where there are big things happening. And those time periods have always attracted my attention, for one reason or another. And that's why I've ended up focusing on sort of two time periods in the history of life, the Triassic and the Devonian, time periods from 200 million years ago and about 375 million years ago. But anyway, I'm going to show you how this kind of way of depicting the history and the sequence of events in our world actually is it gets in the way of really understanding and decomposing some of the main events we see in the history of our planet and life on our planet. And the one I'm going to do is I'm going to take one particular example, one major transformation, the shift from fish that lived in water to limbed animals that live on land. I'm going to take that shift and really analyze it in detail to show you how an integrative approach, integrating fossils and studies with living organisms, can tell us a lot about how this transformation happened. And I'm going to use that as a microcosm, as an example, really, of how we can approach all the other transformations that are out there. So let's start with the transformation from water to land. So here what you have is sort of the transformation from water to land. And you see here, I've sort of shown a cartoon. This is a complete caricature of the situation. And if you were to sort of blue sky this thing, in the back of an envelope, and you know, look at a fish and look at a land-living vertebrate animal with bones, you can sort of say, wow, geez, life in water is vastly different from life on land. Almost every single system of these creatures had to change. And I just sort of showed you several here. I mean, respiration, feeding, locomotion, and head mobility. And if you look at the end states of this transition, it looks really large and indeed almost impossible. Let's just take a few of them. Let's take respiration. I mean, you have a shift from creatures that are largely water breathing to creatures that are air breathing. This involves whole suites of changes to organs and the ways that organs develop and circulatory systems and lungs and so forth. Feeding. Feeding in water is very different from feeding on land. You go from where we have water, where you can suck the food into the mouth by changing the volume of the mouth cavity, to biting, where on land you can't suck in unless you're a Hoover dustette or a vacuum cleaner. It's really more of a biting approach to capturing and chewing food. Locomotion is completely different on land from water. I mean, here you have water supported, but basically you have to support yourself in gravity. That's not gravity supported, but it's basically you're dealing with gravity as a force. And the skeleton had to change from a water supported to actually dealing with gravity as a force on the ground, on the substrate. And there are all kinds of other changes associated with this. Head mobility, you know, fish have heads that are largely connected to the body by a series of bones, so that when you move the head, you move the rest of the body. They don't have necks, whereas land-living creatures have necks, where the head can move independently of the body. Now, for this whole talk, I could have gone through a whole long list of things, from excretion, reproduction, and all kinds of different systems that would have to change. And when you look at these systems, you'd say, golly gee, I don't see how this transformation can ever happen. So my sort of goal for the last 20 years has really been to look at this in detail, to try to collect new fossils, to try to collect understandings from living recent creatures that tell us a lot about how fish achieved this important shift in evolution. This was sort of the state of affairs in 1987. This is a textbook written by one of my predecessors at the University of Chicago, Len Radinsky. And I saw this in 1987 in a graduate seminar, and it really attracted my interest. Because what he showed is a lobe-fin fish on the top. This is a creature from about the first ones of these appear about 380 million years ago. And on the bottom, you see an early limbed creature. This is a creature from Greenland, at least what we thought it looked like at the time. From about 365-ish or so million years ago. And I remember looking at this and saying, golly gee, this is a big transition. There's a lot of features that have to change. And to approach this, it became pretty clear that if we wanted to address this, we had to go find new fossils. In fact, if we wanted to find new fossils that bridge this gap, we'd have to find whole new places to look for fossils. So off we went to start looking for places to find new fossils that tell us about this important anatomical shift. And so, like paleontologists everywhere, there are actually some simple rules to go when you want to design a new expedition to look for fossils. We look for places in the world that have sort of a convergence of three things. The first is you look for places in the world that have rocks of the right age to answer the question that you're interested in. I mean, so I'm interested in the shift from water to land and fish, so it's no mystery that I'm interested in rocks around 380 to 365 or so million years old. The next thing is you look for rocks of the right type. Not every kind of rock preserves fossils. Sedimentary rocks preserve fossils better than volcanic or metamorphic ones. And indeed, within the sedimentary rocks, there are certain depositional environments, environments where those rocks were formed, which are more likely to preserve fossil bone than others for a variety of reasons. One, because they might reflect areas where creatures lived. The other is because they were formed in very gentle environments with little erosion so that whatever fossils were there were preserved in some detail. The third variable is really important. Actually, it's one of the most important ones. It does me no good if my wonderful rocks of the right age and the right type are buried 5 miles underground. I mean, these rocks have to be exposed to the surface. I mean, what we do as paleontologists is walk over rocks for long days to find bones weathering out. So it's really exposures, rocks of the right age, and rocks of the right type. There's a third variable when I started out on this quest, and that was lack of money. And so I started first academic job after leaving Berkeley as a Miller Fellow. I moved to Philadelphia as a young assistant professor here in the southeastern portion of the state. And what I wanted really was a field program that I could do on the cheap or on weekends out of my car, you know, paying like turnpike tolls and gas money. And the first thing I did was obviously pulled out a geological map of New York and Pennsylvania. And the first thing you see when you pull out a geological map of New York and Pennsylvania is you see that the place is just littered with Devonian age rocks. So I basically stripped out everything unimportant out of the state of Pennsylvania. And what's left here is the Devonian. And and you can see, I mean, it's loaded with Devonian age rocks. And these span an age pretty much in the late Devonian is the ones I was interested in. And these were rocks about 365 million years old from the Catskill Formation. And they extend into New York into the Catskills, hence the name. So it's pretty clear from about a three-hour drive from Philadelphia, I had access to Devonian age rocks. It got even better when we started to look at the geology of these rocks. And what geologists knew, the Pennsylvania State Geological Survey was mapping these rocks for years and concocted a cartoon, really, version of what Pennsylvania was like at this time. If you want to think what Pennsylvania is like in the Devonian, get Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, and Philadelphia out of your brain and think Amazon Delta. This is really a cartoon of the reconstruction. Essentially, a series of highlands to the eastern part of the state of Pennsylvania and an inland sea to the west called the Catskill Sea. So if you look at the Devonian rocks of Pittsburgh or Cleveland, you'll find there marine rocks for this inland sea. And a series of rivers that drain from east to west. Now, if you're a paleontologist interested in the transition from fish to limbed animal, and you want to find fossils along this lines, this is perfect. Because you can sample, if you're lucky, ancient seas, ancient estuaries, all the way up the stream, if you're lucky. I was also lucky in this regard because a graduate student started working with me. This is Ted Deschler here. This is a picture of us last year, not when he was a graduate student. We were a lot younger when this whole thing started. But Ted and I have been working ever since, and Ted really has been a major, major, major part of much of the work, fossil work you're going to hear about. But Pennsylvania has a problem. I mean, it has two of these variables. It has, you know, rocks of the right age and rocks of the right type. But unfortunately, it's not renowned for its exposures. Pennsylvania is not a desert. And so it turns out the best exposures for us were areas where the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation decided to put in new roads. What would happen? Or where there are streams. But it's actually the road cuts that were kind of the critical thing. What happens is, you know, PennDOT would come through, and, you know, when they want to put a road or a bend in a road or widen a road, what would they do? They'd blow it up. They'd blow up rock. When they blow up rock, if we were really lucky, they'd blow up rock in the Devonian. And if we were super really lucky, they'd blow up rock in, you know, the right part of the delta system of the Devonian rocks. And this is one area which was widened in the 70s. It's a road about an hour north of State College, Pennsylvania. It's a road cut called, don't be surprised, Red Hill, because it's a red hill. Large road cut. When it was widened in the 70s, it exposed a series of the strata, the beds here, which you can see going up. This is really a fluvial or river environment. And what you see as you walk through here are just like cross sections of ancient streams. Ancient streams, their overbank or marginal deposits. Sometimes you'll see point bars. These streams look like they meander. It has a very classic sort of deltaic, even part of a, and some meandering streams within this area. So it's a really rich area. And you see the scale here. There's a car and there's a human being for scale. What essentially our research program was to climb up and down the sides of these hills. It got a little tricky, but pretty soon, by about 1991, we started to find all kinds of fossils. I mean, the first things we started to see were like teeth the size of railroad spikes coming out of the hills here. Then we started to find jaws of these creatures, and this is Ted holding like one of our first jaws we found out of this thing. This is the front end of a jaw. These jaws are about as long as your arm, and, you know, with teeth the size of your thumb. So there's a really big monstrous fish that are about 16 feet long, you know, up to 16 feet long. So large carnivorous fish coming out of the rocks here. We had lots of other kinds of fish and invertebrate animals. We have this is a sidewall of a fish with, you can see its body armor. It's got a squashed head here. Tons of these kinds of things. And then by about 1993, we started to find bits and pieces of early limbed animals. And this was one that was particularly important at the time. It's an upper arm bone, a humerus. And we started to find a femur, which is an upper leg bone. We found other bones of the skull and so forth. And this humerus was particularly important because it was very similar to that humerus, a humerus known from a Devonian limbed animal from Greenland, one actually I showed you in a cartoon earlier. So it was pretty successful. We started to find, by the mid-90s, a whole ecosystem, really. And I'm not even describing the plants. Some of the earliest known forests with trees. We'd find their leaves and trunks and so forth. Land was loaded with lots of life. Scorpion-like and spider-like creatures, and many of those from these sites, and then tons of fish from within here. And this is what this road cut, Red Hill Road Cut in Pennsylvania, looked like when we reconstructed it with National Geographic. You know, you have that large fish, you know, with the teeth the size of railroad spikes. You have lots of little armored fish around here, and then you have these limbed animals, the tetrapods, literally four-legged creatures, of which there are about three or four types coming out of here. It's really remarkable. But it became really clear that to get to the problem that I was interested in, this transition, we weren't making a ton of headway. We were finding tons of fossils. But these rocks were about 365 million years old. And what we were picking up at this point were mostly really well-formed tetrapods. We were picking up some of these creatures as well. But from our knowledge of the rocks and faunas around the world, it was pretty clear we were probably in rocks too young. We would have had to move back in time. Because to move back in time, we'd begin to understand some of the transition here. And I just want to run through some of the anatomy that's different. You know, here you see the lobe fin fish on top, which we knew was closely related to limbed animals. And you just look at the head. You see basic differences in the architecture of the head. You know, here at the top, you see, you know, these creatures have a conical head with eyes on either side. The early limbed animals have almost like a crocodilian kind of head. It's a flat head with eyes on top. And the architecture of the bones in here actually is somewhat different than the fish on top as well. If you look at the neck, fish don't have a neck. Again, as I said before, the head is actually connected to the shoulder via sort of linkages of bones. and the head is not independently movable, whereas in early limbed animals, like all their descendants, you and I, have a neck where the head is separate from the shoulder, and then there's a series of joints in the base of the base of the skull. And, you know, and finally, I mean, I can make a long list here, but the thing that was really interesting to me was to understand the shift from fins to limbs. Fish have fins with fin webbing. You lose the fin webbing when you get to these early limbed animals, and you gain fingers and toes and wrists and ankles. Okay? And we weren't making a whole ton of headway in understanding this transition. And it became very clear from what we knew, and this is what we were finding. This is the family tree, more or less. Here's limbed animals up here. These are the fish that are successfully mostly closely related to them. If we wanted to make any headway, we had to find creatures that are sort of more on this branch, which would really be able to sort of very clearly tell us the sequence of the origin of key features that led to the origin of limbed animals. And to do that, when we look at the age of these things, many of these first appear back around 380, 390 million years ago. Some of them continue all the way up. The earliest limbed animals, tetrapods, appear about 363, 365 million years ago, at least the good skeletal material at the time, which is what we knew. But there was a big gap in our knowledge. We didn't have many faunas or floras at this age, really, here, at about 375 million years ago. So we had to move back in time. And so we began our hunt again, right? So you look, remember, we look for rocks the right age, rocks the right type, and exposures. And going through it, it became pretty clear we had to, we were thinking about going to Brazil, we were thinking about working in Colorado. Everything changed for us one day in the winter of 1998 in my office at the University of Pennsylvania. Ted and I were having an argument, and to settle the argument, I pulled out a college undergraduate geology textbook. This is, I think, one that I had. It was the second edition of Dott and Batten, Evolution of the Earth. I believe it was pre-plate tectonics when it was written. This book is now, I think, in the 11th edition or something like that. We settled the debate, and as I was thumbing through the book after that little set-to, I came upon this figure in the textbook in, like, chapter 14. And it stopped me in my tracks and basically defined my research, at least in the field, for the next 6 years. So I want to spend a second on this diagram. It's that important. It says Upper Devonian Sedimentary Facies, which means, you know, rocks more or less of the right age, and who knows, maybe rocks of the right type. And what you see here is a map of North America. Here's the United States. Here's Mexico. Here's Canada, Greenland, Canadian Arctic. And superimposed on that is a map of the depositional environments, or the environments of rock formation in the Devonian. And the western part of North America was mapped as an ancient ocean. The rocks there were formed, in the Devonian at least, were formed in an ancient ocean. But these authors, Dott and Batten, and with their citations, identified three areas around the world that were formed in ancient delta systems, like the Amazon Delta today. One of them, the first one I shown in red here, we knew about that one, right? That's the Catskill Project. That's where Ted and I were already working and finding fossils. The second one is up in Greenland. This is East Greenland. I already showed you a limbed animal from there. This is well known. But there was a third area that stopped me in my tracks, and it's an area extending about 1,500 kilometers east to west across the Canadian Arctic, which was mapped by these guys. It's said to be, you know, Devonian age rocks, late Devonian age rocks, formed in ancient delta systems, completely unexplored. And that, you know, that literally stopped us. So we ran to the library, and this all happened in one morning, ran to the library, and there we started to uncover a really wonderful story. And just indulge me as I spend a second or two on this little story. The story begins in 1890s in Norway, where the Norwegians wanted to run to the North Pole. There was a race to get to the North Pole. And the Norwegians had a really bright idea to design a ship, a really strong wooden boat, and that this wooden boat would be sit in the Canadian in the Arctic and get carried by currents up to the North Pole. That was their idea. And they had an explorer named Nansen, who was a remarkable individual in many ways, who helped design this boat. And this boat is called the Fram, which means forward in Norwegian. And it's a truly remarkable ship. This is a boat that took Nansen furthest north, didn't get him to the North Pole, but got him close in the, like, 1890s. It was eventually to take Amundsen to the South Pole in around 1910. You know, so it went from north to south. In the interim, it went to the Canadian Arctic with this crew. And this is the crew led by Otto Sverdrup. He doesn't look like he's a very funny guy. But, you know, what they did was for 3 or 4 years, they went up to the Canadian Arctic, overwintered there on this ship, the sole purpose being to understand the flora, the fauna, and the rocks of the Canadian Arctic. On the boat was this gentleman here, Per Schein. He's the hero of the story. So what they did was they went to Southern Ellesmere Island from 1898 to 1902, and they went to these fjords down here overwintering. And it was a pretty harsh place to overwinter, I could tell you that much. And Shai would get off the boat and start mapping the geology. And this is Per Shai. He start mapping the geology, and you could see here's a fjord he went to called Goose Fjord. And he started mapping it out, and he started to pull out bones of fish. And these were the species of fish, the faunal list that he brought about. Little pieces, you know, flecks and this and that. This was actually to be lost. No one really was to cite this. Per Shai passed away tragically after the return of the Fram. I died at age 30. And this work was subsequently just picked up by a guy named Keir in 1915, who described it, and then this paper sort of sat in the literature, never really cited. Until 1974, this gentleman comes along, Ashton Embry, who was part of responsible for running a mapping project in the Canadian Arctic, mapping the rocks of the Arctic for a variety of economic reasons. And what Ashton did is, in mapping the Arctic, he really did a precise map which basically told us that we had to work there and where we had to work. And the paper that did it is this, and it was published in 1976. And the reason why I'm showing you this paper is there was a single page in the paper that basically told us we had to go immediately to the Canadian Arctic. And this is the page. It doesn't look like much, a lot of words in the page, but I'll blow up two areas for you. Where he talks about age, blow it up, it says, the available data indicate an age of early to middle Fronian. You remember the question mark I showed you before? That's the question mark. Then it really, we lost it, was essentially when we saw what he described as the Fram Formation. The Fram Formation is similar to the Catskill Formation of Pennsylvania. So here we had rocks at the question mark that were similar to the Catskill Formation of Pennsylvania. This all happened in the morning in 1998 in my office in the library at the University of Pennsylvania. We were shaking. There was nothing else we could do. We went to get some Chinese food. So we went for Chinese food. I had my Kung Pao chicken. And this really sealed the deal. I opened my fortune cookie, and it said, soon you will be at the top of the world. So I was like, okay, we're out of here. Anyway, so that was got us there. So this is what, so we're dealing with Nunavut territory. Here's the North Pole. We're 600 miles or 700 miles from the North Pole. This is Ellesmere Island right here. Here's Ellesmere. This is what Ashton maps as the exposures of the Devonian and the Canadian Arctic. He named the key formation, the one that's most like the Catskill Formation, after that boat, the Fram, and it's called the Fram Formation right here. So it's actually right at that right age, the question mark. The earliest known tetrapods, limbed animals at the time, were from up here, so we're significantly earlier in time. And again, just to show you the cartoon, he mapped it as a delta system with a series of highlands to the east and north, an inland sea to the west, and a series of streams and rivers draining from east to west. So off we go. Well, it's a little bit of a challenge because the place is up there, right? It's not here where I could drive with my Subaru to, you know, Pennsylvania. It's up here, which creates problems. I mean, logistic problems. So the nearest town to us where we end up working is a couple hundred miles away. And this is a picture of that town, with a population of about 170 people in spring. It's Grease Fjord, Grease Fjord, Nunavut. It's not, you know, not a hotbed of activity. So it's quite remote, you know, so everything we bring is fairly precious. We bring a small crew, as I'll show you in a second, because we get around through this ferry operation of helicopters and planes. Since we're farther than a tank of gas could take us in a helicopter, so fuel has to be ferried in to get us to where we want to go. So we take these planes, which land actually on the rock and tundra here. It's pretty thrilling, actually, and then and if you define that term loosely. And then the helicopters take us into our camps. Because that, it really affects the science we can do. We can't bring big crews. And importantly, when we find something, and i.e. fossils, which are very heavy, we can't bring a lot of them back. And so we leave a lot of what we find out there, and we, you know, it's a real decision. We're out there for 5 or 6 weeks, and we're making sort of hard choices about what stays and what comes with us. So we started in 1990. The fortune cookie was in 1998. It took us about a year to raise money, and so we went to the western part of the Arctic first. This is what camp looks like, personal tents, main tent. What we do is basically these are the Devonian rocks, and since you have this freeze-thaw in the Arctic, the bones come weathering out quite nicely. And, you know, we walk over the rocks, and when you find bones, you look for the layers that they're coming from. In 1999, we didn't find much. We had terrible weather. And it turns out we were actually in much deeper
ocean, ancient deep ocean that we wanted to be. So following the delta model, we had to move upstream. And what that meant geologically is moving east. And when we moved east to southern Ellesmere Island here, that's when we started to find lobe-finned fish in abundance, bits and pieces of them at least, along these sort of cliff things as we walk up and down the cliffs. The big discovery was made by a college undergraduate, Jason Downs, who joined us 1 year to sort of apprentice. This is the site Jason was to discover in the morning before he discovered it. So about 3 hours later, Ted took this picture. About 3 hours later, Jason was to walk over this little patch here. I don't know if you can see it. It's sort of a greenish-gray patch. We didn't know it at the time, but Jason had discovered an enormous quantity of bone. He was late back to camp. It was actually quite a worry. But he returned to camp with pile after pile of bone. So what we did that night was, since it's daylight 24 hours a day in the Arctic, this is us that night around midnight or 1 in the morning, actually crawling at Jason's site to find the layer that Jason's bones were coming from. Now, this grayish-green carpet here was formed, as I should say, a carpet of thousands and thousands and thousands of fish bones, of which you're seeing like lungfish tooth plates and things like that here. It took us about a year, I should say, a whole year, to actually find that layer. It was actually quite hard. But when we found it, we were able to isolate it. This is Ted here and the crew. The layer was exposed as a series of fish skeletons buried one on top of the other. So Jason's little carpet of fish fragments was formed by skeletons, mostly, you know, half skeletons, occasionally a full skeleton, but it was really articulated material that was coming out. So we opened up the hole fairly large. This is what it looked like in 2006, actually, after a while. And the big discovery happened here with my colleague Steve Gatesy, who was cracking rock and discovered this. I don't know if you're going to see it, but you see Devonian. You see the Devonian rock here. See this little V? And there's a little slash there. This little V, he said, hey guys, what's this? We looked at it. Turns out it's a snout of a fish. And not just any fish, a flat-headed fish. You can tell it's a flat-headed snout. So remember I showed you before, conical head, flathead? Here I had a flathead sticking out of the cliff looking me in the eye. Right? So I kind of knew we found what we were looking for. And so what it became then was to remove these things very carefully. As we removed this one, we found about four more of these flat-headed fish. We now have about 20 of them. In various states, you know, from individual bones to whole skeletons. To the skeletons, we have about five. So they come home on the bottom of a helicopter, and so when these came back, it was in the fall of 2005, the preparators take over, and these are people who work with a needle and pin, and these things come back encased in plaster. And this is Steve's specimen. They sit for months at a time. This took several months. Fred Mollison in Philadelphia did this, removing the rock grain by grain. And here you can see, after about 6 or 7 weeks, a top of a head was revealed. This is one orbit where an eye would be. This is another orbit where an eye would be. It looks like you're dealing with the top of a flat head. A few more months go by, and this was starting to be exposed. Here's the head showing itself. Here's one orbit. Here's the other. This is a shoulder, and this is a shoulder. It looks like we have a neck with no connection of bone to the shoulder. This thing got really interesting. As this was happening, a trial was going on in Pennsylvania, the Dover trial, Kitzmiller case, where intelligent design. And some people were saying during that trial that there were no transitional fossils with transitional features in the fossil record. And here, sitting on our desks, both in Chicago and Philadelphia, were these things exposing themselves. So as we began to prepare it, you know, here's a fish from about 380 million years ago. Here's a early limbed animal from about 365 million years ago. Here's the new fish. I use that term for lack of a better word. What it is, well, we have the extent in size from about a foot and a half long to 9 feet long. The creature here is 4 feet long. I'm only showing you the front half. You can see it has scales in its back. These have been squashed in. Scales in its back and a fins with fin webbing. Yet it has a flattish head with eyes on top. It has a real neck. This is it's lacking an operculum, which most fish have. So it has a mosaic of features of both fish and land-living creatures. So you see, it's a mosaic, like a lobe-fin fish. It has fins and scales and primitive jaws. Like a land-living animal, it has a neck, wrists, flat head, and expanded ribs. So here we have a wonderful fossil with transitional features of limbs, of heads, and so forth. So being the discoverers of this creature, we got to name it. And so we wanted the name to reflect its Inuit heritage. We worked there with the permission of the Inuit government. and Inuit elders. They were very helpful to us, and we wanted the name to reflect its provenance. And so we had a naming project where we engaged the Nunavut elders, these are the Nunavut elders here, to come up with a name to meet two criteria. Criterion number one was a name that was meaningful to them and to us, and number two was a name that we could pronounce. And this is the name of the committee, so the second very... it didn't lend a lot of confidence that we'd have a name we could pronounce. Anyway, so I talked to one of these people. I believe it's this guy here. I'm not totally sure, but we were talking on the phone over about a month, trying to describe what it was. And, you know, I said, well, you know, we have a fish, and it comes in rock. You know, long pause. Well, no, hunters don't find fish in rocks. They're in streams or ocean. Like, no, it's a fossil. And there were so many gaps in the way to communicate here. There was no concept for fossil and so forth. So eventually, one conversation I'll never forget, he said, you know, just what is it? Tell me what it is and where it lived. I said, oh, it's a large freshwater fish. He says, why don't you say so? You have yourself a tiktaalik. I said, a tiktaalik? What's that? He says, large freshwater fish in our language. So that was the name stuff. But anyway, back to the biology here. So we had several of these things. And what we were very fortunate to have several specimens, because that means we can now take them apart to begin to understand how did the bones work? How did the joints work? And then put the animal together again to figure out how it compares to creatures along the evolutionary tree. And how does it tell us about how this great transformation happened? And this is what it's all about. And so here you're looking at one of our large specimens, about 9 feet long. And you see here's a lower jaw, here's another lower jaw. So you're looking at it like this, the two jaws, like yay. And it was one specimens like these that we started to take limb bones apart. So we found here's an upper arm bone, a humerus, and here's a shoulder. And so we took all these things out, and we were really fortunate in that not only did we have many of the bones of the fin, so you take off the fin webbing, this thing had fin webbing, and then you see, just like our arm, if you were to look at your own arm in the skeleton, you have one bone, upper arm bone, two bones in the forearm, a series of joints here that as they go distally, they can flex and extend, and those joints go all the way out to your fingers. And that's essentially what you have here, one bone, two bones. You have a series of joints that are capable of flexion, just like your wrists and fingers. And indeed, we can compare these bones, this bone here and this bone here, to bones that are actually in amphibians, creatures for lack of a better word, and we can compare them up and down the evolutionary tree. What got really interesting is when we took the bones apart, we were able to take each joint apart. So what we did was we took the shoulder apart, and here's the shoulder of Tiktaalik. Here's the socket on the shoulder. Here's the ball on the humerus. And we can see that from the detailed shape what the likely and unlikely patterns of kinematics of motion of one bone on the other would be at the shoulder. Very unusual shoulder in some ways. It has a ball, but it has a sort of cam stop here, which would prevent it from this action of protraction. We can see the elbow of Tiktaalik. Here's the radius, and here's the ulna. And you can see the sockets where they'd fit on the elbow joint of the distal humerus. This is the arm bone, and you see where they'd fit on. And you can see how this one facet would sort of rotates this down this side here. That means this bone could rotate far down into the plane of the slide. That's important, as I'll show you later. And then we can do it for every other joint in the thing. It was really remarkable to be able to do that. And what we're doing now is actually modeling it digitally to see how these bones would move on one another. But to give you a sense of all this, let's just look at the shoulder. And I have three creatures here. I have one, a lobe-finned fish. This is a Eustonopteron. Here's an early limbed animal, Acanthus stega, and you're seeing the shoulders here from the side. Okay, so you're like looking at the animal from the side like this. And here's Tiktaalik. One of the things is you can see the shoulder socket here in Acanthus stega, and you can't see it in Eustonopteron. Well, if you pop on the humerus, you can see the upper arm bone, you can see what that means. In Acanthus stega, this early limbed animal, the humerus or upper arm bone is coming out at you like this. Like a crocodile. So the limb is held to the side of the body. Whereas in fish, like the like Eustonopteron, the humerus is facing backwards. Like this. In Tiktaalik, it's different. It's rotated. The whole joint is rotated, so it's sort of intermediate in position between the bone that faces to the side and Acanthus stega and backwards in Eustonopteron. Then you just add the other bones in. If you add the forearm bones, the radius and ulna, turns out that the radius and ulna in Tiktaalik, just like Acanthus stega, are capable of flexion, like yay. And indeed, the radius can rotate inwards in what a motion called pronation, like moving your thumb inwards. And when you add the other bones in, we can begin to see what Tiktaalik was able to do. Tiktaalik is specialized to do a form of a push-up with elbow bent, and wrist extended with a small set of palmish bones, it can, and remember the fin webbing is sticking out here as well, you can support the body in a form of a push-up with a palm equivalent flush against the ground. What was nice about these specimens, too, and this is something we haven't really published yet, is the notion that we can begin to see how the fin webbing changes during this change. So you're looking at the type specimen, one of the better specimens of Tiktaalik, from the top, and here you see the fin with its fin webbing. We have several of these specimens that are intact, which show the relationship between the limb bones I just showed you and the fin webbing. And that's really important, because if you look at a fish like Eusthenopteron, and Acanthostega, you see the big shift in the fin webbing. They lose it. Fish have fin webbing. Limbed animals do not. If you look at Tiktaalik, it's reduced the fin webbing, but it's done so in a very important way. It's done so not from the outside in, but from the inside out. It's done it over the joints. So where it's lost the fin webbing in these big rods is over the elbow joint and over the wrist joint, which totally makes sense. Those are the areas where the fin would bend. So this is sort of more or less what we think what the fin of Tiktaalik was able to do, function like a paddle or like a prop, enabling the creature to do a push-up. This is the reconstruction of Tiktaalik as it was in 2006. It has a flat head with eyes on top, a pair of nostrils, has a neck where the head is separate from the shoulder, and key in this is the loss of many bones, including the opercular bone, which is the bone and a whole series of opercular bones. It has a fin webbing, and inside that fin webbing is an upper arm bones, forearm bones, the equivalents, and both proximal carpal and distal carpal bones, that is the equivalents of a wrist. Big expanded ribs. We now know a lot about the hind fin with the pelvis and so forth. We're lacking the femur, so that's why I haven't drawn it in yet. One of the key things here is really understanding Tiktaalik as a living animal, because then we can begin to see this transformation, and that's what we really want to get to. One of the things about Tiktaalik is if it's supporting itself, as the appendages suggest, on the ground, like in a push-up, that's when the neck becomes quite handy. If you look at a fish, it has a head fused to the shoulder, and it does so by a series of bones at the back of the skull and a series of opercular bones, a whole opercular series that connect the cheek to the shoulder. These bones, I should say, the opercular bones have several functions. They actually connect the head to the shoulder, but they function in breathing in fish as well. They're pumps that draw water across the gills. One of the big changes in the transition to tetrapods, to limbed animals, is the loss of all these bones. So not only do you have a neck, but you've lost the operculum as well. And it turns out Tiktaalik is much the same. It's evolved the ability to do push-ups, and at the same time, it's lost all this whole series of bones here. And what this shows is, with this opercular series, is how one change, loss of simple bones, can affect several traits of the creature, from head mobility, which is important for locomotion and the variety of behaviors it has, to breathing as well. Because as you lose the operculum, there are new ways that have to come about to bring water through the mouth. So what's Tiktaalik specialized to do? Here's the reconstruction. It's a benthic animal, able to live on the water bottoms with a flat head with eyes on top, looking at prey as they go by. It's also an animal that's able to live at the margin of water and land, and to feed, it's a carnivore, to feed either on fish or on the large variety of invertebrates that are present on land and in the air at this time as well. So if you look at the family tree, if you plot with all the various characters that we can do, Tiktaalik turns out to be very closely related to limbed animals. And so no surprise given all the features that we found. Now, to really make sense of this, and to get back to the whole point of the talk, which is really understanding great transformations, you remember I opened up the fact that this is an integrative discipline. This is something where we have to pull in data from many different lines of inquiry. It really comes down, we have to think of ways to integrate these studies of fossils. And I should say right off the bat that Tiktaalik only gains meaning in relationship to the other fossils that we have in this sequence, in this series here. Okay, it alone doesn't tell us anything. It's this whole batch of things which tell us how this transition happened. But we really have to begin to think about what living fish can tell us and what lessons can we learn from them about how fish evolved to walk on land and to live in land. And there's a couple things. I'm just going to isolate three. One is we can study their genes and genetics. That is, we can look at the genetic recipe that builds the bodies of fish and builds the bodies of land-living animals, and we can ask the question, what's different among them? And we can do that at the level of organs. We can do that at the level of tissues. We can do that at a variety of different levels with increasing precision every year. We can look at appendage support. How do fish support themselves with their appendage? What are the models of living organisms that do this kind of thing today? And we can look at air breathing. How does air breathing happen in fish? And, you know, we could do with, this is arbitrary, I could add another four or five things on here, but I wanted to give you some take-home messages about what we can learn from living fish. Well, if you look at it, what I'm going to show you here is what you can see are limbs. These are fins up here and limbs down here. If you take living creatures alone with no fossils, we have limbs with one bone, two bones, little bones, and fingers. And I'm showing you a chicken and a human, and they have a one bone, two bone sort of finger arrangement as well, despite the fact that it's in a fin. And if you compare it to fish fins that are alive today, they don't look a whole lot alike. Here's a lungfish here, a creature, Neoceratodus from Australia, and it has one bone, okay, down here, but it doesn't have any other bones that look very limb-like. Neither do any of these other fins here. Where the comparison gains meaning, or when we add the fossils to this evolutionary tree, that we begin to see this one bone, two bone limb pattern appearing and evolving in our own lineage. So if you just take living creatures, this transition from fin to limb looks vast. But when you start to add in the fossil taxa, the fossil creatures and species, you begin to see the links between them. But really where it's important is we can study the genetics and developmental biology of living creatures in a way that we can't do with ones that have been dead for 375 million years. And when we do that, what we can begin to understand is the genetic toolkit and the recipe that builds the skeleton of an appendage. We can begin to ask the question is, what are the set of genetic interactions that build the pattern of one bone, two bones, little bones, fingers? We begin to ask the question, what's the genetic recipe that controls the number of bones in different parts of the body, its size and shape and so forth? And if we do that, we can begin to see, and by about the late 90s, we began to see that there's a very characteristic set of patterns of gene activity and gene function, genes called the HOX genes and others, I'm not going to go through them all, that characterize the development of limbs. It's a cascade of events, of cellular events and genetic events, that produce the pattern of limbs. So I'm going to talk about that more tomorrow. However, what was really interesting is we knew what this stuff was, how it was happening in chickens and mice and frogs. The real surprise came when we started to look at these genetic interactions and processes acting in fish fins. And what was truly remarkable is that many of the genetic processes that build the fins, the skeleton of the fins of fish, and indeed that pattern them, are very similar to those that pattern the limbs of limbed animals. And in fact, it's very clear that, you know, if you were to ask the question, are there any new genes that are patterning the limbs of limbed animals that aren't present in fins? The answer is likely no. That is, it's not like the origin of limbs necessarily involved the origin of whole new sets of genes. It involved whole new sets of genetic interactions and new ways of genes being turned on and off in new places and so forth. So it's using existing genes in new ways and reconfiguring them. So the genetic, if you are, the toolkit that's necessary to build appendages was already present when a lot of these fossils hit the scene. So the repertoire was already there. If we look at appendage support in extant creatures, what you'll find is a lot of fish actually support themselves with their appendages. Most famous among this is the mudskipper. Mudskippers can live on land for a period of time, about 24 hours, about the max in the mud, and they have appendages with a little type of elbow. And if you look at frogfish, a frogfish is a creature that can walk in the water. This is actually an aquatic creature that can walk around. It even has a little sort of elbow and a distal paddle. What's remarkable about all these creatures that have evolved to sort of walk or support themselves with their appendages is oftentimes they do it with equivalent kinds of joints, shoulders and paddles and so forth. But in each case that they do it with different bones. So here is the frogfish fin. And you remember, we have this one bone, two bone, little bone ray pattern. This is nothing like that. This is three bones, a big old plate, a big old rod here, and a bunch of spikes coming off. That's very different from the limb pattern in limbed animals. So what you see is when fish that are distantly related to Tiktaalik and other creatures evolve appendage support, they evolve similar kinds of joints, but they do it with different sets of bones. Only one lineage did it our way, and that's the Tiktaalik lobefin fish lineage. Finally, you can ask the question, you know, the creatures that, you know, doing appendage support and walking in mud and so forth, how do they breathe? Well, if you look at the evolutionary tree of fish, and you ask the question, how many of these things are air breathers? There are about 30,000 different species of fish, say 29,000 of them or so. Of those that are looked at so far, in the last major monograph, somebody identified 375 species of air-breathing fish, which is what's been looked at. There are certainly a whole lot more, in 49 different families, and if you map it to a tree, it evolved at least 24 times. That likely is about three times too low, based on if you look at the trees that it was mapped on. So air-breathing in fish has evolved many times independently in living, extant fish. And how do they do it? The most common way that fish breathe air, at least in the evolutionary tree, is they use lungs. In fact, lungs are primitive. Lungs are primitive to this thing here, a polypterus, to lungfish. Indeed, if you look at Tiktaalik and where it fits on this tree, Tiktaalik's right about here. So lungs hit the scene well before Tiktaalik and even its distant relatives were around in Devonian streams. They evolve in these cases. In each case, like in the lungfish, they evolve to allow creatures to breathe when water gets anoxic and oxygen poor. They go up and gulp air in many different ways. And there are other examples as well. There are diverse air-breathing organs in this group here, which is very speciose. Some of these creatures vascularize their swim bladders. They vascularize their mouths. There are numerous strategies for air-breathing in fish, but lungs are the ones that are actually primitive to our own lineage. So returning to the initial sort of challenge, with air-breathing evolving multiple times independently in fish, with the genes necessary to build limbs already present in fish fins, with appendage support appearing in numerous kinds of fish independently, with intermediates in the fossil record at just the right time in the fossil record, you don't ask the question, how could this transition ever have happened? Ask the question, why did it happen only once? This barrier between water and land seems to be very porous, at least for creatures that are specializing for the interface between water and land. And why did it evolve only once? I can only speculate. In our lineage, it only evolved once. Perhaps it's some sort of ecological king of the hill situation where you have an incumbent and it sort of displaces any other lineages that would evolve to walk on land because there's already an incumbent set of species there. So all this is, in terms of it's extrapolating to great transformations, one way of thinking about great transformations is the popular one you see day to day in cartoons and oftentimes in texts, which is as a ladder-like notion of change. That is, one species leads to another species leads to another species. That's not how it works. That's not how the water-to-land transition works. That's not how any of the other great transitions works. It's not like Tiktaalik and its kin were sitting around thinking, oh, golly, I want to evolve lungs so I can walk on land. I want to evolve wrists to walk on land. It was adaptation to life in water. It was diversification in life in water, finding new strategies to live on the water bottom, in the shallows, in the interface between water and land, on the mudflats and so forth, that led to the diverse adaptations which became useful when the need came to walk on land. And so what we think about is evolution not as this ladder, but as Darwin originally proposed, as a tree of evolution with a diverse set of strategies evolving. And I should say that there is a unifying theme to many of the great transformations. I'm going to just close with a series of these. You can think of the transformation from something like, the common ancestor of an acorn worm and the earliest fish with a skull. If you look at this change, if you look at creatures both living and long dead, what you'd find is a wonderful series of creatures with transitional features between acorn worm and fish. And I should say, some of the most important species in this transformation have been discovered in the last 30 years. You could say the same thing with any other great transformation. Take whales and their derivation from four-legged creatures about 50 million years ago. You could find fossils that have a series of transitional features leading to whales. Devise a family tree well supported by characteristics, which show how the sequence of changes happened. And again, the major fossils that support this transformation discovered in the last 20 years. And the same thing is true with the shift from reptiles to mammals, to the evolution of our own species, Homo sapiens, from our primate relatives, from birds to dinosaurs. When underlying all these transformations is this, that some of the most important fossils in understanding the great transitions in the history of life have been discovered in the last 30 years. And when you think about this field, these are the great times in understanding great transformations. Nowhere has it become easier to find fossils from around the world, to analyze them in new ways with new imaging and new quantitative techniques, to study living creatures with understanding their genes and genomes and sequencing at an ever-rapid clip. to understand the genes that build bodies and control development, to understand the biomechanics of the features that these creatures use to walk and to live, to understand the ecosystems and the systems that are function as ecosystems and the food webs, the ways these creatures would have interacted. At no other time in the history of our science has it been a better time to study the great transformations, because this is now a fundamentally integrative field and an integrative biology. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.